This is Dave Crippen, and we're in Ann Arbor on June 15th, 1984. This is another in the series of our design history oral reminiscences by seminal designers in the field of industrial design, and especially in automotive design. And today we are interviewing Mr. Alex Tremulis, who is well known to students of design history.
Yes, Dave. Perhaps the seeds of my ambition to become an automobile designer were planted in 1919 when my father, Dr. Sorantos Tremulis, in the middle of a snowstorm in Chicago, drove home in a 1919 Templar Roadster. My mother was shocked at the awesome sight of this gorgeous automobile, sans doors, which required a step plate above the running board in order to climb in. There was absolutely no evidence that the car had even a top, as the only way to get into it was to unloose the top by unscrewing two agate marble balls, which were attached to the windshield and were fastened to a bar. When lifted up, was attached to a canvas top. When unrolled, it was about the size of one square yard, which afforded 20/20 vision on both sides of the rear view without enduring the indignities of peering through the traditional isinglass curtains, which were prone to turn yellow and develop cracks after several months of usage. The dealer had furnished at no cost a pail, a shovel, and a brush, with the instructions that by removing four screws, 4 or 5 inches of snow could be whisked out the bottom of the car in a matter of minutes. Equipped with a cutout, my job as a 5-year-old co-pilot was to open the cutout when Dad was overtaking or passing lesser cars on his emergency calls. My father's philosophy was that we are in the midst of the worst flu epidemic in America's history. Thousands are dying every day. The only way to save lives on emergency calls was to go from point A to point B in the fastest time possible. Dad had ordered the Templar with a Munson-Duesenberg engine, which was good for 90 to 100 miles an hour. I will sum this facet of my life with indelible reflections of the roaring exhaust note that symbolized the true coat of arms of Motor Dom's aristocracy. The next impact that influenced my dreams of becoming an automobile stylist occurred in 1922 when I was exposed to the aerodynamics of Paul Jarret and his automotive philosophy. Jarret was born in Vienna in 1889. In my opinion, Jarret was the father of automotive aerodynamics. Unfortunately, as for many inventors, clients preferred to wait for 17 years when patents would expire, thus escaping the payment of royalties. His works were a great inspiration, and it stimulated Chrysler's thinking in the development of the Chrysler Airflow. In a special issue of Aerodynamics, August 1982 issue, I authored an article, Tunneling Through the Ages, and paid a great tribute to Paul Jarret, who was virtually unknown in this country. Unfortunately, some of the great pioneers of our profession have never reaped the rewards that they deserved. In high school, I had no idea as to whether to become an automobile designer or an aircraft designer. My two instructors, Bernard Bulova and Paul Lahan, were my idols. Would you believe that the Air Force was so desperate to find design that Major Schroeder, Chief of Aircraft Development, was touring the high schools all over the country searching for talent? He was so impressed with my aircraft designs, which were most controversial at that time, because I had talked about retractable landing gears and assumed that aircraft wings would tolerate no wires to brace the future wings, and that in the future, wood main spars would be replaced by aluminum structures. He insisted that I go to McCook Field, which later became Wright Field, and that they would train me and make me a designer without going to a college. Bear in mind, in the Depression days of the early 30s, pure advanced research was a luxury that the government simply could not afford. He was looking for a natural creative talent and believed that I could make a contribution to the art. One day, several spools of streamlined wire arrived at our high school. Paul Lahan suggested that I take three students and replace the wires with streamlined wire. I was shocked at the increased weight of the wires, but was told that streamlining was more important than weight reduction. Our World War I Jenny airplane would gain a speed of 100 miles an hour with the new wire versus 95 miles an hour with the round wire. I was so impressed with such a simple solution that I asked, what would happen if I applied the same philosophy to an automobile for my thesis? He thought it was a good, splendid idea. I designed a super streamlined Duesenberg, 1/16 scale on a 153-inch chassis, and finished it in 1933. Everything was tuned just right and opened doors for me at the Chicago Duesenberg sales office, where I did sketches for clients that wanted minor changes made in styling. 1933 was the year of the World's Fair and was a tremendous year for automotive design. Pier Serra had come up with a radical streamlined car that certainly forecasted the future. Sponsored by Roy H. Faulkner, who was vice president of Pier Serra, discovered a young stylist by the name of Phil Wright and ordered 10 cars built. Not to be outdone, Cadillac showed a streamlined coupe on a 148-inch 16-cylinder chassis. Amos E. Northrop, chief stylist of the Murray Body Company, was a distinguished designer of the Rio Royale, the Graham Blue Streak, which was the first car to show fender skirts, and then showed a series of design sketches that showed the future trends in well-rounded, swept-forward front ends and fenders. Chrysler also got into the act when they introduced the Chrysler Airflow. At this point, I must digress for a few moments. The Airflows created a paradox. I, for one, never disputed Chrysler's philosophy of moving the engine forward some 18 inches. By doing this, the rear passengers were now sitting ahead of the rear axle and no longer sitting higher over the traditional high kick-up over the rear wheels. Ray Dietrich was the chief stylist. He should have been the vice president of styling so that he could at least have crossed swords with the body engineers on an equal level. Up to that time, the auto stylist in the first 25 years of my half-century career were all treated as step children. In many companies, we were labeled as the pretty picture boys who would design automobiles that no one on earth could engineer or build such a design. Ray Dietrich must have been one of the most frustrated designers in the profession, as he was not allowed in the sacred inner sanctum. It was strictly a ball game for the body engineers. The best example I can think of is that we were at times as compatible as cobras and a mongoose. The airflows turned out to be financial disasters and were simply labeled as air flops. The stigma was so devastating that, in my opinion, it set the styling situation or the profession back some 20 years. Ford Motor Company was not alone at the World's Fair, thanks to John Jarda von Sturkenberg, who had an illustrious background as chief designer of Van Den Pla, a highly respected carrozzeria. Jarda was a squadron leader in the Belgium Air Force and had a subconscious feel for aerodynamics. Jarda left Europe and joined the GM Art and Color section under Harley Earl, who is recognized as the father of the automotive styling profession. Differences of opinion occurred as Jarda was a rear engine enthusiast and Harley Earl would have none of this. Since there was room for only one monarch at General Motors, Jarda left and joined Briggs as head of styling. The Briggs LeBaron styling section we have to smooth that out. As head of the Briggs LeBaron styling section, our clients were Ford, Chrysler, and Packard. At Briggs, we operated as a gesture of the goodwill division, and charged them nothing for our services, and merely fed our clients our advanced thinking for their company line of cars. In essence, in my opinion, we were the first of the automotive think tanks. One of our most frequent visitors was Edsel Ford, who, like his son, Henry Ford II, were the greatest true champions of advanced styling and inspiring engineering. One of my assignments was to put on paper Mr. Edsel Ford's thoughts, and one of the greatest pleasures in my career was to work with him on his concept of a rear engine car he called the New Era. Had that car seen the light of day, designed by Mr. Edsel and illustrated by me, VW would have never had the audacity to invade our shores. Edsel had a very strong feeling for the pure sensitivity of a line and a feeling of lightness versus the thick radiuses of the top-heavy-looking roofs of that era. Let's put it this way. There might never have been a Continental without Edsel's design critique, as I see his fingerprints, or I saw his fingerprints, all over the original Continental. Edsel was really a man of great forward vision. Had he the power of decision, as we entered the 1940s, it might have been Ford number one and GM number two. Unfortunately, the best years of his career were vaporized under the ruthless, sadistic denomination of Harry Bennett. Henry Ford II certainly inherited a mess at the start. That's when he got out of the Navy and all that. Going back to the World's Fair, Briggs Body showed a highly streamlined rear-engined automobile with a periscope that forecasted the VW Beetle. It was powered by a Ford, I believe a V60, and had phenomenal performance. A year later, they showed a front engine version of the design. These were probably the first of the dream cars by Ford, Briggs, and LeBaron. The true test of styling is that it must survive the acid test of time. Edsel's crease line was the first in styling history. In three more years, the New Era will have survived any critique of half a century. Then my Duesenberg Streamliner, a most radical design, was observed by Howard O'Leary, second in command at General Motors Styling under Harley Earl at the auto show, and he offered me a job at the GM training school. I studied for about 3 months at the school, and I was told to go to an art school and learn how to use watercolors and then come back. I went to an art school in Detroit and then went back to Duesenberg. I worked for the legendary Gordon Buick, who designed the 1935 Cord A10, a styling masterpiece that may well be regarded as the outstanding styling achievement of our century. Gordon left Auburn Cord Duesenberg for greener pastures at a very attractive salary at Bud Manufacturing. I was asked to replace him as chief of Auburn Cord Duesenberg Styling. It was a very hard act to follow, as I was only 23 years old at that time. Auburn Cord Duesenberg was losing money at that time, but I somehow gave them a stay of execution by designing the supercharged cords. If you recall, the exposed exhaust pipes emanating from the hood sides. And for the first time in 3 years, our red ink flowed into black ink on the company's books. However, sales were still low, and the Cord Corporation had to make a decision as to form a company called American Airlines and invest in the future of air travel at the expense of Auburn Cord Duesenberg, which became the sacrificial lamb. We terminated all production of motor cars, and one of the illustrious companies of all time became a tragic statistic and joined the ranks of some 5,000 auto manufacturers that have failed in the world. The automobile has the highest rate of attrition and indicates the adage that survival belongs to the fittest. In my career, I've worked for more than 20 automobile companies. Reflecting back to the failures of the profession, one gets an insight into the mistakes that caused their failure. or induced their failure. The happy medium was to play safe and make annual changes, not to advance, and at the same time not to stretch out models when they were off the pace and started to look old. Let me cite a few examples. The 1929 Model J Duesenberg in its first year sold 225 cars. In 1930, the full impact of the Great Depression reared its ugly head, and our production decayed to 50 units a year. Somehow we managed to survive, and the last Duesenberg was built in 1937. In all, we built 471 cars in 7 years. Through these years, we simply had to keep Duesenberg alive as a status symbol, with an image of superb engineering, performance, and styling, which would reflect down on our bread-and-butter cars. Would you believe that in our initial order of 500 units for the Duesenberg, we purchased our front fenders in heavy-gauge steel with prime paint for $7.50 each? And a rear fender cost us only $3.50. Even Cadillac had their problems. The bread-and-butter cars of Cadillac and LaSalle all had V8 engines. Cadillac, in order to maintain their prestige cars, had to go to 12 and 16-cylinder engines. I now find it unbelievable that somehow or other that Cadillac could survive on a production of only 400 cars a year on the 16-cylinder car. At 6,000 pounds, it sold for $6,000 at $1 a pound. At the other end of the scale, Auburn cars, let's say from 1927 to 1934, were setting sales records and high earning records and were advertising, "Where can you buy an automobile for 27 cents a pound when the best steak in town will cost you some 30 cents a pound?" Auburn's secret of success was that it offered high performance and superb styling. That was the winning combination. Even large companies can make mistakes by not extrapolating the future. As an example, in the 30s, Body by Fisher was a household word and impregnated in the public's mind that bodies built of wood and steel were far superior to all steel bodies. They eloquently demonstrated the wood and steel syndrome by having weightlifters stripped to the waist, bending tubes of their thin-walled steel with a quick twist of the wrist. Then he would take another steel tube and insert a wood dowel rod and grunt and groan. Then girls in gowns would hand out to all waiting in line two pieces of steel tubing and one dowel rod. I would say that 90% of the people at the show, including me, walked out from the auto show, no doubt to demonstrate to their kids this astronomical demonstration of sheer brute strength. A few aisles down, Chrysler was introducing their all-steel bodies with their turret tops. I would guesstimate that 80% of the people at the show were convinced that GM could do no wrong, and what would happen to poor Chrysler with their tin roofs? Chrysler retaliated at the World's Fair by building a ramp and having an elephant that weighed in at 8,000 pounds stand on its roof. Is it really? I was just wondering. Auburn Corps Duesenberg might have made it, except for one big mistake. They introduced the car prematurely. We had a budget for $2.5 million for tooling, but no transmission. Gordon Burick's A10 cord was so beautiful that E.L. Cord felt that the people would gladly wait for a month or two until we resolved our transmission problems. Cord wanted 100 hand-built cars for the auto shows. I don't know how many were built. All I know is that the tooling budget was reduced to $1.5 million, which meant that instead of one big bang for a roof panel, we had to build a roof out of 6 or 7 pieces, which required 60 to 80 pounds of lead. Metal finishers were the highest paid at 85 cents an hour. In Detroit, it was more like $2.50 an hour. Our prices escalated to the point where you could buy two Cadillacs for the price of one supercharged Cord. That was the beginning of the end. When the Cord empire collapsed, the Cord tooling was sold to Hupmobile and Graham, who felt that front-wheel drive and V8 engines were too expensive, and that off-the-shelf six-cylinder engines were the way to go with rear-wheel drive, and that they could cut the cost in half. I was retained because of my experience at Auburn Cord Duesenberg by the president of Hupmobile as a consultant. Consulting is a very precarious position to be placed in. You have only two options. Number one, you tell the client what he would like to hear, or number two, you tell him what he should hear. I chose the latter, which was a calculated risk. I strongly recommended that he spend $150,000 for a one-piece roof, and all his tooling men agreed with me. He retaliated by stating, "I'm not interested in saving money. I only paid $40,000 for the Cord dies." My answer was, "You just bought yourself $40,000 worth of junk." I was paid off and fired on the spot after 3 days. The lesson I learned was that if one must break necks, one must do it very, very gently. It's a shame that both Graham and Hupmobile failed in their venture, as both cars were very beautiful, as they had the reputation of having very loyal clienteles of satisfied owners. I could sense this from my father's 25 cars that he had owned, and also that he had owned, as 18 of them were Studebakers. I also recall that when some of the Studebakers were not running right, that he would refer to them as steady breakers. I recall one appalling statistic about 20 to 25 years ago. 6 people a year were murdered in barroom brawls fighting over the merits of a Ford versus a Chevrolet. Broken jaws, teeth, and arms or legs might account for 100 or so casualties in the hospital. The past is prologue. At this point, let me reflect a bit on the past in order to properly define the mechanism of thought that will trigger the explosion of technological progress. Before I get to that point, my tour of duty in 1937-1939 at Briggs LeBaron were highlighted by the pleasure of working on the Edsel New Era and my creation of Chrysler's first dream cars. After leaving Briggs, I went to California and worked for Custom Motors, a venture located in Beverly Hills on Rodeo Drive. This venture was financed by Eleanor Powell, world famous for her tap dancing, which is now showing a renewed comeback. The company was managed by Sid Luft, who married Judy Garland. In her dance routine, she was clocked at 13 taps per second, and she referred to that step as the machine gun. Each tap only took 7/100ths of a second. At any rate, we built 7 or 8 Cadillacs and did minor customization restorations. My first exposure to many small cars was to design and build a 2-passenger prototype, roll-up window, American Bantam coupe called the Monte Carlo, and a 4-passenger convertible called the Riviera. Oddly, both names were eventually used by Cadillac. War clouds were appearing on the horizon, and I decided to enlist in the Air Force. I wanted to either get into some phase of design, preferably aircraft design. I had recalled that Major Schroeder, who I met in high school, showed some interest in my talents, so I spent a couple of months and worked up a portfolio as to what I thought military planes should look like. There was no place that they could find a spot for me. McCook Field had reached a population of 2,000 people, and a new research facility had to be built. A move was made to Dayton, Ohio, which was named Wright, as it eventually exploded to a population of 30,000. Miles and miles of laboratories at the opening ceremonies were shown. General George Brett said, "In our laboratories at Wright Field, we have the greatest minds in America. The destiny of the airplane lies in their creativeness. At Wright Field, there was no room for buck privates. One had to be either on civil service or an officer. I was to be turned down unless I became an officer. They would look at my designs only after I received my commission. Then I was assigned to mechanic school. Then a very funny thing happened. I purchased a pair of two-tone shoes, and on my way to the school, I was stopped by an officer who remonstrated me for being out of uniform and then wrote me a slip that I was to turn over to my commanding officer. It was like a ticket for jaywalking. In utter disgust, I went to my barracks and got my portfolio, walked to a flagpole, which was the nerve center of Chanute Field, and made the mistake of walking through the officer's entrance. Then I saw a sign on the door, Colonel O.L. Rogers, Commandant. I opened the door and realized that I had walked through the wrong entrance. After an exchange of salutes, he wanted to know my problem. I simply stated that I was at the wrong field. He retorted, "In what field do you think you belong at?" I stated, "Right field." I showed him my... When the reporters asked, "Where is the front fender and is there a rear fender?" So I walked over to the rear quarters of the car and I pointed to a sculptured change of pace in sheet metal, which is very subtle. And I pointed to it and I said, "This is where the rear fender used to be." So the cameras start clicking. They said, "Wait a minute, let's do it all over." So I repeated that a couple of times and they said, "Oh, wait a minute. The way to do this is to get a ladder." So they got a step ladder, a photographer went up high. They showed me a three-view drawing of a 200,000-pound bomber and a series of prints. I said, "That's no way to sell an airplane. You sell it like an automobile, with a brochure." I picked out a drawing board and had them get me a compressor, and armed with my airbrush and working 16 hours a day, When the colonel got back, I had the most beautiful 16x20 brochure, all in airbrush drawings. He was dumbfounded. We had 15 minutes to catch the mail plane back to Bowling Field and radioed ahead for a staff car into the Pentagon and right straight to the office of Major General Oliver Eccles, Deputy Chief of the Air Force under General Hap Arnold. General Eccles was dumbfounded and exclaimed, "Any idiot can now understand this design. I want to see every design at Aircraft Laboratory illustrated this way." I established illustration studios in all the laboratories of the field. All the doors were open to me, and I was to report to General Eccles once a month for 20 to 30 minutes with sketches of what I thought was going on. My assignment would fill a book. In a year and a half, they gave me the Buck Rogers room with complete freedom of expression. I was to imagineer a future Air Force. Well, we can stop right there and go back and see what you think.
I'm interested in asking you some questions about the Charta 1934 Century of Progress. Can you elaborate a bit on how that came about? Did Edsel Ford actually go to Briggs and say, "I want something for the Ford exhibit in Chicago"?
That I really don't know. All I know is that John Jarda, when he was designing automobiles, he would design around Chrysler engines, which meant that the client was to be the Chrysler Corporation. In the case of Ford, you must remember that Briggs was the largest builder of bodies in the world. They could cut the costs. Even the Ford Motor Car Company in its heyday could never compete with that. And he may have picked another perhaps General Motors engines, but the disagreement that he had on design philosophy, Harley Arrow absolutely refused to even think in terms of even building an experimental rear engine automobile. And John Jarda was the apparently was very much impressed with Ford engines, especially the V8s, and built this mock-up, I believe it was a wood mock-up, of the 1933 Dream car. It was a very beautiful car. When I say it forecasted the VW, the VW in no way had the design perfection that Jarda had put into this automobile. Then he built a prototype, and I feel sure that this was no doubt either sponsored by the Ford Motor Car Company. And to prove his philosophy of aerodynamics, you must remember at that time, Ford was building two V8s, one that developed, the small one, developed some 60 horsepower, and the larger V8, 85 horsepower. And what he was trying to prove, and he did prove, that with the 60 horsepower engine, while no aerodynamic figures were ever disclosed, they didn't understand the art and the coefficient, the drag that we talk about today, it is now becoming a household word. That car showed phenomenal mile per gallon efficiency at speeds like 60 miles an hour. I would say that that car was capable of 30 to 35 miles on a gallon, but it could do 115 miles an hour with only 60 to 65 horsepower. So obviously Ford showed a great interest, especially Edsel Ford. Now Edsel, of course, was a tremendous enthusiast when it came to automobiles. He loved automobiles. He used to go to Europe and he would buy sport cars. And in some ways, he was considered controversial. Henry Ford, the first, sincerely believed that he could go on and on and on with the Model T and just jam it down the public's throat. And after all, there were some 15 million of those cars produced. When you get right down to it, I think VW, in their history, has built 25 million cars. They've actually outproduced. And I suppose in sheer desperation, there were people like Ernie Kanzler, Senior, who I think was a sales executive for the Ford Motor Car Company, and he implored Henry to, my God, let's stop building these four-cylinder automobiles. Chevrolet's coming out with a six-cylinder car, and it's a stylus dream, and that was the end of the Model Ts. But at the same time, Ernie Kanzler was fired by the Ford Motor Car Company. I guess Henry Ford disagreed with his son's philosophy of living in Grosse Pointe, and you can read many stories of the ruthlessness of Harry Bennett, and the Fed still entertained with a cocktail party, as most everybody does. There'd be a team of Harry Bennett's men who would break doors to get into his home and destroy every evidence of liquor and whatever. The Ford Motor Car Company, really, Briggs made quite a an impact as consultants, gesture of goodwill department. And designers like Phil Wright. I think Phil was responsible for the 1935 Ford. And Jarda, of course, had a tremendous influence on the Lincoln Zephyrs. I was always impressed with the Lincoln Zephyrs because now for the first time, yes, from the start of what I've been talking about, I was always dreaming of a very happy marriage between aircraft and automotive technology. That this would be the solution to our future energy supplies. Of course, way back in those days, after the fiasco by Chrysler, streamlining became a very dirty word. Now, the aerodynamic coefficient, most experts agree, and the calculations that I've made sort of confirm, that the Chrysler airflows had a coefficient of drag of 0.51. In the meager test data that was done by the Ford Motor Car Company, in which they used their tunnel, they had a wind tunnel there that's called a weather tunnel. They can freeze a car to death, they can heat it to death. But since it had scales that determined velocity, they were able to put all their automobiles, ranging from a Model T to a Model A, and all the way on through the new generation of cars, such as the Lincolns, the Mercurys, even the big Lincoln went into the wind tunnel. And then they disclosed up to 70 miles an hour in increments, starting from 20, 30, 40, going all the way on up. The pounds in drag. And you just looked at the drag figures. The only thing missing was that they didn't really tell you what the funnel area of the cars were, but we can guesstimate that in those days, cars like the Lincoln Zephyr were approximately 28 square feet in frontal area, and then multiplied once we were able to take the pounds drag at the velocity, it was very simple to arrive at a CD. Now, ironically, the best streamlined car in that era was the Lincoln Zephyr. And that Lincoln Zephyr had a coefficient of drag of 0.47 versus the 0.50 or the 5.1. Now, Ford never said the Zephyr was a streamlined automobile. They could have bombarded the whole press and said that the airflow became an air flop because it violated certain rules of aerodynamics. And they just kept quiet about it. Even later, I remember, every company has what I always call a Custer's last stand. They've either produced a turkey, they're embarrassed about what they have done, and they somehow have to ignore their advertising, which advertising and apologizing are practically the same as far as I'm concerned in some cases. It's a weapon that has a two-sided sword. John Jarda developed, in my opinion, for the Chrysler Company, trying to save the Chrysler philosophy. And that was a very beautiful fastback sedan. It had catwalk cooling as if it had two radiators, which was sort of inspired by the Lincoln tradition, with the sharp nose only swept forward. The front and rear wheels were completely enclosed for good aerodynamics. And had Chrysler bought that automobile, it would have started a new trend in aerodynamics. It was much better looking than the Lincolns, which were really gorgeous automobiles.
What year was this, Alex?
This had to be about 1937. Chrysler executives came in, K.T. Keller came in with Dave Wallace. They took one look at the thing. they probably gave it a 30-second scan and says, forget it. The public will never buy streamlining, and let's go back to conventional profiles. So Chrysler had to take a very severe backward step and go real conservative. And they got so conservative that I think in 1952, this is a very classic, I have to skip all around in because reflecting back, you can forget things. And but they, Chrysler came out with the super functional automobiles, which they regarded. And they used such statements as, the car is bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. It approached the aerodynamics, as far as I'm concerned, of the lowly brick with rounded corners.
This apparently was K.T. Keller's philosophy,
oh, yes.
Was it not?
That's right.
I've heard a story that he wouldn't ride in any car unless he could wear his hat.
Oh, very definitely. And you must remember something. The Chrysler stylists were at a terrific disadvantage. As an example, when K.T. Keller would get into an automobile, and he'd have the steering wheel here, he'd sit there as if he were a mannequin, and they would take dimensions and start changing the numbers on Oscar. Consequently, because he weighed. Now, a model came out one time, a show car designed by Virgil Exner, which was called the 310. That number signified the fact that Chrysler claimed it could develop 310 horsepower, but other people claimed, no, that's K.T. Keller's weight of 310 pounds, and that's why the steering wheel had to make room and would go forward some 4 inches. And so they had to start developing. In order to get that 4 inches back, they thrust the sheet metal of the front end some 4 inches ahead, and to compensate for this. K.T. was a very interesting fellow, but what had happened was very interesting. I always felt very sympathetic for the failure of the Chrysler airflow philosophy. I mean, it made a lot of sense, really. The rear kick-up was gone. People sat between the axles. Very exciting ads appeared, one that I've never forgotten. A person sitting in the rear seat, as an example, saying, I am writing this letter at a speed of 80 miles an hour. Then you'd look up at the roof up there, and the roof had this aircraft feeling where they had seams, some in leather and some in chrome. Even the furniture was terrific. They were the first ones to come up with seats that were supported by this chrome tubing. They could have made a lot of money just building ultra-modern chrome furniture. And Ralph Roberts now appeared on the scene. Ralph Roberts, and now I'll have to get to possibly around 1938 and a half, 1939. Ralph Roberts, who was one of the founders of LeBaron, was sent to London, where he became chief of Ford of England's styling. And he took Bob Cotto along with him, and they became Ford styling of Europe. Smaller cars, and they did some very beautiful little scale down. They still had to preserve the image. Well, the war clouds were now starting to appear, and Ralph Roberts came back to Briggs LeBaron. And he was on equal status as far as the executive position with John Jarda. And he was going to set up a separate styling section and borrow some of the designers from John Jarda's group, either on loan for temporary projects and all. Ralph really really wasn't a stylist, but I call him a stylist. I mean, just the fact that he was lacking in watercolors or illustrations. I think the line drawing, pencil line drawing, if it's done right, and then becomes a model, that's the true statement of design. Sits down and on the drawing board and starts picking up several sweeps, and then starts laying out the basic dimensions of the chassis and then an automobile. Was doing some very funny things. He was designing scooters that had tops on them, side curtains. Of course, now he was geared to the geographics of London, where they have they're constantly engulfed by rain clouds, and the sun is something that's a luxury to see. Like in Germany, they all walk out, they stop work when the sun comes out, and then they go back again. And I just made a very humorous statement. I says, "Ralph, I think you've been in England too long." He says, "What do you mean?" I says, "Look, everybody, the trend is the bigger, the longer, everything's big in America. And we don't have the narrow streets that they have in London. Scooters are great. I think you're on the right track there. But I don't see any production or anything coming here that'll influence the automobile designers." And I said, "You've got a lot of contacts with K.T. Keller. I know that. He likes you. He's always respected you. Why don't we come and do a couple real radical streamlined cars and try and erase the sins of the Aeroflot?" So he said, "Well, what do you think we should do?" I said, "Well, we got to do things dramatically. People are interested in high performance and all that. And we got to establish an image that aerodynamics will give us the kind of performance that they really want in the future." So I think what we ought to do is go through the history of the land speed record cars. So I said, "I'd like to write an article or a presentation, and it'll be that the measured mile creates a new motor car." He said, "That sounds like a good idea. Why don't you do it over the weekend and make some real rough sketches, and we'll both go and see K.T. Keller and Dave Wallace." So I made some very fast sketches, and I said, "Well, let's go and see what happens." Now, I acted more like I was an advertising expert, not a designer. I start flowing out, "The measured mile creates a new motor car," and which is unmistakably Chrysler's thinking. So I started out with a series of sketches, the measured mile that started at Daytona Beach, and then eventually filtered on way up north to the Bonneville Salt Flats. And I started out with the 999, Henry Ford, the 99 miles an hour, whatever, 96 miles an hour, something. And then went on to the early cars of Sir Malcolm Campbell, 174 miles an hour. And then Major Seagrave, the first to do in the Mystery S, 203 miles an hour. And then he comes back with the Golden Arrow. Ah, that was the name, Golden Arrow, at 231 miles an hour. And eventually along comes Captain George Easton in the mighty Thunderbolt. And who eventually went up well over 300 miles an hour. And as they would narrate this at the auto show, on big pieces of paper like this, I spent about 2 days until I was exhausted. I'd go through the whole history as they were talking, as fast as I'm talking now. about each individual automobile. That was the time I had to spend to illustrate this. And then a very beautiful model, and sometimes if a beautiful female model wasn't available, a man in a tuxedo would take this stamp pad, bang, courtesy of the Chrysler Corporation, I'd rip the sheet off, throw it on the floor, and the kids would all scatter for it. And pretty soon it got so hectic that after one day of this, we hired some creative artists, and we gave them a very light template with an outline that they could see, and they would, with this chalk, would just, or pastel that they used, move. Some guys were real good at drawing wheels, and some weren't. Nevertheless, everybody figured their quick sketches, and they were passing them out like that. And now, when I was in, I wanted each and all these cars to reflect the personality of the cars I'm talking about, such as the Thunderbolt was a great big single piece of sheet metal. It had six wheels on it. It had two big aircraft engines in it, and I think it was a really four wheels, a four-wheel drive thing to get traction. And that created the Thunderbolt automobile. I made a great big singular piece. You couldn't see the individual fenders. Every car had four fenders. This was a full-width automobile. And K.T. Keller looked at it and said, looked at the drawing, and what I had done, on the door I put a bolt of lightning. And he said, now what's the name of the car? I said, it's the Thunderbolt. And he says, well, where does the Chrysler emblem fit? Well, Chrysler had a round emblem in those days, and to me, I hated the thing. It looked like it was stamped from a cookie mold. And I said, there is no Chrysler emblem. He said, what do you mean? If we're going to build this automobile, it's got to have the Chrysler emblem on it instead of the zigzag you have on the door. I said, that is the Thunderbolt. The very fact it's on the door with no nameplate signifies that it is unmistakably a Chrysler, who were the great pioneers of aerodynamics. They opened the doors. And he says, that's it. So he said, you'll have to excuse me for a minute, but Dave, keep on hammering on this. I like the idea of the Thunderbolt car. And he walked out, and Dave Wallace said, okay, we love the name. KT likes it. And now I've got to, let's get on the phone. And it was really amazing. He says, why don't you call Colonel George Easton? And I says, I don't have his address. And he says, he talked to the secretary and said, well, he's somewhere in England. I think it's London. And I says, wait a minute, the best thing to do is call Autocar Magazine. If anybody knows where he lives, it's Autocar Magazine. So we got a hold of Auto Week, and we got in touch with him. This is real exciting for me, because now this was a transatlantic phone call. So I called the good colonel and said, we are designing a show car that was inspired by your illustrious Thunderbolt. And he says, sounds capital. And what we're calling for is to have the rights of using that name. So he said, well, how many cars are you going to produce? So Dave Wallace gets a hold of me and he says, give him anything. We want that name. So I says, we're going to build one or two cars. We may build five cars. We haven't the slightest idea. And we've got 90 days to do it. And he said, well, he says, that sounds fine. What's the logo? I said, there is no logo. He said, you mean classic or what? Well, what kind of lettering? I said, there is no lettering. It's the Thunderbolt zigzag. And that personifies lightning speed. And he says, Capital again. He says, however, if you ever use that name on a production car, I intend to ask for royalties. And I said, rest well assured, and here's Dave Wallace, just like that. And all those vice presidents in those days used to wear hats. They had a hat rack, but they never used it. If there was a fire somewhere in the plant, a change, something happened on the production line, valuable seconds were saved when you could just rush out to wherever the danger signals were and simply solve it and then come back. And sometimes I looked at Dave Wallace and figured, boy, this guy would make a great used car dealer. I mean, the widest brimmed hats that you could ever see, you know. And sometimes we used to play tricks on each other because we did the same thing with Briggs, such as tacking a hat onto a drawing board. And when someone would grab the hat and rush out, there would go the brim, and everybody would laugh. And, yeah, well, you're going to buy me a new hat, and that's it. But it was traditional. There were some funny traditions in those days. I remember in Packard, where I made several trips to see Edward B. McCauley, who was head of Packard Styling at that time. Second or third time around, as I walked through, the receptionist said, "We understand you are walking through the hall, and with your hat on." And they said, "It's traditional here that when you walk through the hall, the halls of Packard, you take your hat off." And I feel, well, it's a sign of respect. I suppose I'll have to do that. But getting back, see, I had just come from Auburn Corps Duesenberg, and I figured, gee, I've worked for an automobile company that builds the world's finest motor car, the Duesenberg, and Packard is another one of the illustrious marks. Gee, my ambition is to work for Packard. So I went to Ed McCauley, and he said, "No," he says, "let me say something. You wouldn't be happy here. You'd be too conservative." He said, "But if you really want to do something good for Packard," he said, "you go to Briggs LeBaron, and I'll be happy to call John Jarda and recommend you for the account." I says, "No, let me see if I can do it on my own." And so I went to see John Jarda, and sure enough, I got a job. But I didn't have to call Ed McCauley, and sure enough, they did put me on the Packard account. I made maybe 60 days just working on the new Packard Clipper or whatever. Because Briggs LeBaron always managed to hire the most outstanding designers. They paid more money, and John Jarda, of course, was a brilliant designer, no question about it in my mind. I admired him. He was, I don't know if I stated it, he was a squadron leader, understood aerodynamics and all. He even experimented with automobiles that had leaning suspensions so you could bank through a corner. Sometimes he'd even get out of his field, and he created an engine department, not only for automobiles, but also aircraft engines, based on the Briggs Aspen rotary valve philosophy. Okay. We were way ahead of our times, and he actually was determined to vaporize General Motors. After all, he was second in command, and he dreamed of rear-engine automobiles, anything less is a relic of the Stone Age or the Napoleonic coach regime. Very well liked by the Ford Motor Car Company, all of them admired everything that we were doing at Briggs LeBaron, whether we used it or not. Now we had the awesome task of building two automobiles. That meeting had sold the Chrysler Thunderbolt and the Golden Arrow. The Golden Arrow was designed by Ralph Roberts. It was a magnificent automobile. Both cars showed the new trend. The Golden Arrow was a double cowl Phaeton, and the front fender went and flowed beautifully into the rear fender. The Thunderbolt had no fenders at all, let's say, until I got it to the auto show. We had a lot of problems even thinking. The sketches we made on the Golden Arrow just didn't apply to this double cowl Phaeton, but we still liked the name, and we painted it sort of a yellowish gold. And I had four very beautiful gold-plated arrows that when I got to the auto show with tape, I was to put them somewhere where you think it looks good. The Chrysler Thunderbolt was a very radical thing as far as body engineering was concerned. Where can we make a windshield like that? Now, this has got to be a curved piece of glass that spans maybe 60 inches. No one can make a piece of glass that big. And they were ready to cancel it because K.T. Keller and Dave Wallace said, you've got an order for these two cars, but you got to guarantee that they can be finished in 90 days for the show. And Mr. Wojtypka, who was chief body engineer of Briggs, said that, there's no problem except for the Thunderbolt. And he said, we'll have to forget the Thunderbolt. We'll never be able to develop the windshield. So I says, wait a minute. I'll compromise with you people. I'll settle for a V-shaped windshield with flat glass, like an Auburn Speedster. And they said, okay, that we can do. We'll just make a bronze casting frame, and that's it. As the thing progressed, they finally figured, let's take a gamble and see if we can make a piece of glass. And it was maybe body engineering's finest hour, because they were sympathetic to what we were talking about and went all out to make sure that they could bend glass, as an example. Now, when I fly into New York for the New York Auto Show, I get the shock of my life. Here I am with these beautiful Golden Arrows, and I see the Golden Arrow with a big sign on it. They changed the name to the Newport. So I think, holy smokes, what am I going to do? So I showed the arrows to Ralph Roberts. He says, oh, they're beautiful. Gee, thanks a lot. But I should have shown him just two and kept the other two as a memento. Now, meanwhile, the photographers want pictures of me standing next to the Thunderbolt. So I explained that this is the maximum width aerodynamic automobile. And then I get over to the rear end, and I had a very subtle change of pace of sheet metal. And where are the fenders? I went to the back rear quarter. Was it, when the reporter is asked, where is the front fender and is there a rear fender? So I walked over to the rear quarters of the car, and I pointed to a sculptured change of pace in sheet metal, which is very subtle. And I pointed to it, and I said, "This is where the rear fender used to be." So the camera started clicking. They said, "Wait a minute, let's do it all over." So I repeated that a couple of times, and they said, "Oh, wait a minute. The way to do this is to get a ladder." So they got a step ladder, a photographer went up high, and then pretty soon they start shooting down from the top. "This is where the rear fender used to be." And then they reiterated by bringing in a larger one, and they start clicking, and that was possibly the final photograph that they showed the car. And of course, we were in competition with General Motors, because General Motors was also building dream cars. And Harley Earl had just shown the famous Buick Y car, which also had retractable headlights, and the Chrysler. And of course, the Chrysler was really, it had a very beautiful front end that was very smooth. No semblance of a grill, because we scooped air under the bumper, the front bumper. Chrysler's, we beat the whole world to the punch. We had a stainless steel rocker panel that K.T. Keller really didn't like. He said, "It looks like a Bud Streamline train." This was during the three-quarters. The quarter scale model stage, and I said, "I need this thing desperately. I've got to have that stainless steel band down there." And he said, "How are you going to wrap it around the corner? Stainless steel, you can't bend it." I said, "We'll make that out of brass and then plate it." He said, "You know, you designers sometimes think like good engineers." So I got by with that, and I sold it. The both cars were seen by 6 million people all over the country, and I think we built 6 Thunderbolts and another 6 of the Newports.
What year was this?
This had to be 1939 for the 1940 auto show. And so I thought I was a big hero when I got through with that automobile, but Briggs LeBaron had a budget cut because of what was happening in England, and that affected them also, because they were still Briggs of London, let's say. And we, I decided then, well, I should have no problem getting a job from Chrysler. I should have waited till K.T. Keller came back from Europe. But I went over there, and Oliver Clark was the chief body engineer of the Chrysler Corporation, and styling was under engineering's command. The highest you could be would be a chief stylist like Ray Diedrich before you even thought of becoming vice presidential caliber. And I was interviewed by Oliver Clark, and he talked about politics. One classic statement that he made was he didn't like President Roosevelt, that if the national debt ever hit $40 billion, this great country would collapse. And of course, I nodded and agreed with him. I had to. And he says, "Now, what did you do at Briggs LeBaron?" I says, "Well, I worked on Packards, I worked on Fords, and we also did a lot of work for you people at Chrysler." And he said, "What did you do for us at Chrysler?" I says, "Well, I was responsible for the Thunderbolt." And he looked at me and said, "That is the homeliest looking bathtub that has ever appeared on an automobile." He stood up, grabbed me by the arm, walked me out, and then stopped when he got to this next, which was the receptionist room, and he pointed to a photograph, which is about 4 feet by maybe 3 feet, and it was a plan view of a 1927 Chrysler that looked like this in the plan view. It had this OG curve like this, and then out here with the fenders here. And he said, you destroyed the most beautiful OG curve. This is the OG curve right here. In one bold stroke with that bathtub. Don't ever step into our offices again. And I was literally thrown out. And I always had felt great compassion for the poor Chrysler stylists. They had some very brilliant designers there. One of them, Herb Weisinger, and Bud Grissinger, who later came on to Ford and distinguished himself with the Mercury division. I think he was responsible for the back end of the 1956 T-Bird. It carried the spare tire, but they worked out rear bumpers that exhausted the through the bumper, which was a very nice concept. And the talent at Chrysler, in fact, one time I did make a statement during one of his visits, K.T. Keller's visits, looking at the clay model that I was doing. I said, I can't understand why you've come to us for a car like this. Surely you must have some people who have the capability of designing an advanced car like this at Chrysler. He says, no, there's nothing there. I see nothing there. No one can do anything like this. He was enamored with the name and the philosophy and the complete vindication of aerodynamics. You may think we designed air flops, but just look at this thing. This is the future, blah, blah, blah. And I said, you know what you should do someday? You should sneak into the styling section and open up the drawers and take a look at what they're hiding or what they really want to do. He says, well, he says, I see what they've done, and that's it. I got enough problems with them. So the styling was never fully appreciated. As I said, we're pretty picture boys, and that was about the state of the art there. Let's see, we're talking into the 30s now. We're talking to the great industrial designers. Actually, we had no schools. The best you could do would be to go to an art school and learn how to use various mediums, oils, and watercolors until Norman Bell Geddes, in a book entitled Horizons, in which he forecasted the future of airliners, streamlined locomotives, automobiles, and actually he was a consultant to the Chrysler Corporation also on the airflow projects. We suddenly became, after reading that book, or just looking through the photographs, it suddenly occurred to all the readers that a new art had emerged on the horizon, advanced thinking and very dramatic forecasts of the future were coming in. And we called it the birth of industrial design and automotive design. And it was a fresh viewpoint that a new approach. It was a quantum leap into the future. Bell Geddes, I think all of us owe a great debt to him for his inspiration. Now, who was the designer we were talking about? Who?
Walter Darwin Teague.
Walter Darwin Teague. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Now, Walter Darwin Teague also designed and built several automobiles. I believe he had the Marmon account. One was a 16-cylinder car. And along with people like Raymond Loewy, who was also emerging on this new aerodynamic approach with the Hubmobile line of cars, the first of the panoramic windshields. Actually, these cars were inspired by Panhard Levesser, but refined, let's say, by Raymond Loewy, who went on to bigger and better things with Studebaker and all. But Walter Dorwin Teague, as an example, was possibly one of the highest priced people. When he designed the Ford Rotunda, they asked him how much money he would charge. And he says, "I can't tell you." He said, "We're going to have to build it, and whatever it costs, if it costs $2 million, then my fee will be an additional $2 million. And I'm going back to right field now when we're interrogating these people. We want to know what the cost is going to be for a museum of sorts. Norman Bel Geddes also walked in, and he looked at the building we had proposed in, and he says, "Nope, I'm not interested. There are too many posts holding up the roof." He wanted a big, fantastic. So that I think that led to a group of architectural designers who walked in. Wish I could remember their name. It'll come back to me. But it was a foreign group of Swiss designers who sort of revolutionized the architectural motifs. And I think that they came up with a very dramatic shape, no posts or anything. You could just put B-52s in there, the B-19. You could hide anything in there, and it wouldn't be interrupted by any structures. There were other great designers. There was a Donald Doner of Pratt Institute, who was a very magic name. There was another designer by the name of Alexander Costolo. I think he was Romanian. And he was the automotive design expert. And they were really subsidized by General Motors. Now, General Motors had, when they were looking for students, they were getting all the people that were inspired by Costolo. And consequently, when he passed away, it was a very great blow. Pratt Institute has never been the same. His wife inherited the automotive styling thing, and it was never, it could never compete with schools like Art Center or Cleveland School of Design. And those are the real schools of the future.
Did Pratt institute the first industrial design course?
I think so. Donald Doner, a lot of people say, from what I've never met the man, but he, in my opinion, from the way the students have talked, Donald Doner was the inspiring catalyst for the whole design profession, from lawnmowers to whatever.
I want to ask you one quick question about the Charta 1934 Ford World's Fair advanced design. Do you, there's been stories to the effect that Dr. Ferdinand Porsche was influenced by that design in the design of the Volkswagen. Do you have anything to add to that theory?
Very definitely. I really believe that 90% of what he saw in that car was used on the VW. I give it 100% if he had eliminated some of the sculpturing that he had there. But the Briggs Body Special, or the Ford Special, I forget what we used to call that, 33 car. As you say, 34, the World's Fair in Chicago was extended another year, so we went for 2 years there. And I won't even mention the other gentleman we were talking about, who supposedly world's greatest paper hanger also made a few recommendations as to what it should be.
The Volkswagen.
Yes.
What happened to John Charta in the after he left Briggs?
After he left Briggs, he opened up an industrial design firm of his own. And he showed his tremendous imagination. I was in uniform at that time, and I stopped by to visit him, and he was delighted to know that I was at aircraft laboratory in a position to make recommendations. He wanted my thoughts on this cargo plane that he had designed. And he showed me a very advanced model of an interior of a cargo plane in which all the boxes and crates that were carried in there were attached to a myriad of cables, so he could distribute the weight very evenly and under critical landing speeds and angles of attack, that you could preserve the CG of the airplane, eliminate weight shift that could be a disaster. And then he showed me a line of automobiles. You must remember that at one time, Jarda and designed a car that was, let's see, the Ford executive. I'm trying to think of his name. You might shut this off till we Sorensen. And John Jarda were to get together, and they were to build a new automobile, and it would be a rear-engine four-cylinder car, which was exactly what Edsel Ford was talking about when he designed the new era. I merely illustrated it for him and made a few little changes on some lines and all that, which we all agreed on. The car was to be called the Cortez, and Palm Springs in California was to be the new styling section, and Norman Bell Geddes was to design the whole structure. So this was to be a Shangri-La for styling. Unfortunately, I don't know what happened, but the project never came through. But at that time, when Jarda walked in, he looked at the Tucker automobile and felt that, they'll probably never build that automobile. And he offered me a job there at a very attractive salary, which is probably, but I had to stay and finish the Tucker automobile. And consequently, his financing just didn't come through. But I don't know, was Sorensen fired from Ford?
In the 40s,
mm-hmm. Yeah, that was probably it. This is probably one way of getting back in the automobile industry.
This would seem to be a good time to move you back, or to move you forward into the seminal influences of the Air Force on your, design philosophy.
Well, when I got into the Air Force, I was strictly labeled as an illustrator. Well, number one, I had no academic background. But I had a subconscious feel for beautiful aerodynamic shapes. And aerodynamics is a very complex art. So much of it can be explained with differential equations, one after the other. It was the day of the slide rule was king. They placed very severe restrictions on aircraft. The placement and aerodynamic thicknesses played a very important part. How much do you want to lift? How fast do you want it to go? The compromises and all. Today, a computer can just design 10 airplanes in one day. In those days, an airplane, by the time you designed the airplane, you had to lay it out first, and then you'd go through the big yellow book. Everybody had a book on whatever project this particular airplane was. One of the first things was takeoff capabilities to clear a 50-foot obstacle at an empty weight or at the design weight, the range weight, and the maximum speeds at all different altitudes, the proper altitude to fly at for the range and all that. it was a lot of balancing and just exactly what do you want and what does the enemy have? What do we have to do to compete? Meanwhile, I was designing very exotic shapes and jet aeroplanes and was strictly labeled as, well, when he gets out, when the war ends, he should get a job with Buck Rogers. And he's a good cartoonist, and he can draw better spaceships than Buck Rogers and all that. But the state of the art was, now meanwhile I was talking of, we've got to go Mach 1, we've got to go Mach 2 after, and that'll come. And they said, no, I said, I was designing airplanes at that time where the ailerons were. I had jetterons, and they said, what's that for? I said, when we get up to 100, 200,000 feet, wings are meaningless up there. A change of direction can only occur when we use these jetterons and we force hydrogen peroxide fuel through. They just stated this. The chief aerodynamist, and he's a very brilliant man, just shook his head and he stated, man is a terrestrial animal. He will never fly higher than 100,000 to perhaps 120,000 feet. And airplanes will be limited to Mach numbers of 0.8, 0.9, as a Mach number of 1 means total destruction of the wings. And I was shocked. I said, you can't place a ceiling and tell us that there is a maximum speed, because then, if that is it, then we are no longer a profession. We've hit the ceiling and that's it. And we're just going to have to crash through somehow. Years later, when I talked to him after we broke through the sonic barrier and all that, he made a very classic statement I've never forgotten. He said, Alex, you and I are involved in a very scientific area. And he said, there is no such thing as an ultimate airplane when we're dealing with Mach 1 phenomena. And he stated that the closer we can only get to the ultimate airplane very slowly on the basis that when you lift the pencil from the final drawing, that act signifies that it is now obsolete, because another sheet of paper over it means that you will have improvements. And I said, I'm not interested in the slow improvements. I want to know, what do we have to do to go Mach 1? I've got sharp, long fuselage shapes. I was the first to put a pitot tube on the nose of an airplane, which they called a shish kebab. And they said, why are you putting it there when traditionally we always put it in the wing? I said, because it looks good. What looks good is good. Because there was a time when we used to have, in the early stages when I got there in 1941-42, well, we would have our wind tunnel models, and we would sit there and look at each model, and the ultimate winner would be, as we looked at it, what looks good is good. Now forget all this aerodynamics. The state of the art, as this colonel said, okay, let me show you what's going to happen. Let's take the finest airplane we have, the P-51, which is a 400-mile-an-hour airplane. Let's force it to Mach 1. And then he went on, he pulled out his 6-inch slide rule and went to the drawing board and says, do you realize we've got to have over 200,000 horsepower to push this thing through the air? This airplane is too small to even put a 200,000 horsepower engine in there. By the time it gets there, the wings are going to disintegrate. They had us so scared that when we did the preliminary work on the Bell X-1 plane, which was a rocket plane designed by Major Orazio and then turned over to Bell Aircraft, as I pointed out before, we were the product planners of an aeroplane. We told the aircraft industry we need a 200,000-pound bomber, we need a 300,000-pound bomber, we do the pick-and-shovel work. We would then turn it over to the companies, and we gave them the right to make all necessary changes, because they had the staff, and to build any number of extra wind tunnel models, and that we'd usually